When life happens and you need care fast, you can Teladoc that. Need help navigating big changes? You can Teladoc that too. From checkups to check-ins and everything in between, for your physical health or for your mental health, you can Teladoc all that. We've got doctors, therapists, specialists, and coaches all available by web or app. Get started today at TeladocHealth.com. That's TeladocHealth.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's show on the offense from that win over the Bears. Excited to talk about this. We have a great guest today, Jeremy Kahn from 105.7. Jeremy, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. It's good to see you again today. So,
yeah. How you doing since this morning? Yes. Yeah. It is one of those things. So Tuesday morning is my day to go into the radio station. By the way, would love to have one of you listeners have a good phone call, really good, thoughtful question that would come in on Tuesday morning between 8 and 8:30, if you get the time to do it.
We should start pubbing that a little bit more and have people send it through your mailbag. I know you talk about it, but like, I think it's good to get the interaction from them.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I mean, the segments are kind of limited in terms of the total amount of time, especially relative to my own, you know, unlimited rabbit hole conversations I can have here for 2 hours. It's kind of limiting to be on for two shorter segments on the radio.
Well, it's fun to have you in. And I know when we talk about it, like a lot of guys will have on for one segment, but you put so much work into this, it makes sense to sit here and break it down in two segments. I wish we would sit there and go, hey, this one's the offense and this one's the defense, but we all have different ideas of which direction we want to go in. So you just get peppered with whatever's there.
No, it's cool. That's cool. Yeah. It works. And you guys got your favorites and you kind of do a little round robin in terms of questions usually. And Ed definitely likes the defense and Rob probably likes the offense more, I'm going to say. And you have a different slant entirely, but one of the reasons I love to have you on this show is because you bring a gambling acumen or a true contrarian viewpoint mm-hmm. on gambling to the show that I really appreciate.
Yeah, man, it's funny. I don't know how much people know, but we were sitting there talking in the commercial break and I'm talking about these parlays and then I'd name a number and Ken would tell me, oh yeah, that pays out this, or it's this, that's plus 1200. That's plus. And it's just amazing. But those are the types of things that, it's one of the reasons why I love coming on with you, because I know you see it differently as well. And I've said this before, I'm a guy that I could sit here and talk about anything on the football field. The only time I can talk about the offensive line is when they're really bad. Because I think a lot of times you see it. Outside of not hearing someone's name, that's a good thing. And I look for your grades and to see what you think about it.
I appreciate that, Jeremy. We'll get into that in part two here. But let's talk about this great game here, because I mean, one thing is not only could we not believe what the gamblers still think of the Ravens, even at 1-5, mm-hmm. but the difference in terms of what we can believe about the Ravens between 1-5 and 2-5 is amazing. I mean, now the Ravens are the favorite to win the division again, and a pretty substantial favorite at that. And it does not seem unreasonable to me. All of a sudden, everything seemed unreasonable a week ago.
It's not. And people look at it like I saw in some places Ravens minus 105 to win the division. You got to understand those are actually fantastic odds when you consider where they're at. And the Steelers are like plus 175. Now, for a team like, I was going to say Buffalo, but the Patriots are playing better this year. But for a team that's going to dominate the division, let's just take the Colts, right? For the Colts, they're probably going to be minus 1200 and then minus 2000 to win their division because they feel like it's a lock. But seeing how far the Steelers are back, it really tells you what the books feel about them. And that's why I was coming into this game. I mean, Harbaugh's amazing after bye weeks. And you look at what they did. And when the point spread only dropped 4 points, you know, when it closed, that said a lot to me, because with the Rams game, it dropped 11. I mean, it swung the other way. So I think there was something put into the fact with the Ravens coming off the bye week and the success they've had and getting healthy in other spots. Oh, you muted? Oh.
Yeah, the health factor was a big one. They got back two key defenders. We talked about that on the defensive pod yesterday. Give that a look. But the return of Roquan Smith and Marlon Humphrey for this defense was absolutely enormous. But, you know, they got through it with Tyler Huntley in this game. We're gonna talk about two other nominees for this, but I think it was probably the greatest performance ever by a Ravens backup quarterback, not just in Huntley's career, but I've got two other good nominees for you. And they are stiff competition.
Yeah. There was one that came to my mind in a very high scoring game with five downs, right? Is that the one with Anthony?
Anthony Wright. That's right. Yeah. That's one of the two. That's one of the two I have. We'll get to those a little bit later, but they moved the ball effectively, really for the first time with Huntley in the last several years. They've had times where they've had, you know, spotty effective moving the ball, including that playoff game. They moved the ball a little bit in that game in the loss. They got the ball moved. They did enough to win offensively versus Atlanta and versus Chicago in two games in the past. But generally speaking, with Huntley, they haven't moved the ball pretty well, and I haven't moved the ball particularly well. And Huntley is a guy who has an incredible amount of incredible lack of pocket awareness. And I mean, the guy is like a lost squirrel running around the pocket. Sometimes he kind of, I don't like to make animal references to humans, but I'm going to do this in the light it's given. Hopefully he won't be insulted too badly about this, but the early sack that he took, he was handling the football in a way that he shouldn't after the defender had passed him. And it was as if, like your dog is looking out a window and they can see a dog and they'll bark, bark, bark. And then the dog goes out of their view and then they stop barking because the dog doesn't exist anymore. It was like that in terms of him holding the football still too far away from his body because he thought that the threat was gone. And it wasn't. It was right there behind him. And the ball got almost pulled loose for a fumble on that first sack he took.
With his name being Snoop, I think it's okay to compare him to a dog.
That's bro.
You're right, though, because, like, I'm watching this all the time. I was watching the Saints quarterback, and I know we're talking Ravens, but comparatively speaking, when you look at a young quarterback and not having the presence of mind, understanding how fast the game is at this level, you can kind of understand it. You see a guy that's been around the league for a little bit like Huntley, and you're going, okay, you got to realize it. You have to have that clock in your mind of, okay, he's by me, I have to realize it, securing the football, because it's one of the weirdest things in the game that you touch a guy's face mask, you grab it, it's a penalty, but by God, if you're in front of me and I want to come clothesline you from behind or punch you in your face, I can do that because I'm going for the ball. And it doesn't even take all of that to knock it free. You know, you just need to surprise the guy, and if you're carrying it like a loaf of bread, more times than not, you're going to have to turn the thing over.
Yeah, damn straight. Damn straight. So the other thing that was a big news from this game on the offensive side was Keaton Mitchell kind of running wild in a limited set of opportunities. We've got some specifics to talk about there that I thought were, more than a little entertaining, but we got kind of a view of Keaton Mitchell, kind of like we did in that Seattle game a few years ago, where all of a sudden the Ravens had found a shooting star.
Yeah, I mean, you almost, like, when I look around the league and see how teams use the dual back system, whether it's a rookie that's coming along, like in Denver with Dobbins and R.J. Harvey, you might have the same thing in Miami, which you'll see this week with Achane and Ollie Gordon. But, you know, having a vet like a Derrick Henry, who you want to give the bulk of the carries to, I love the fact that you have a guy whose skill set is good, and it's totally different than what Henry brings to the table. And I still don't understand. I mean, maybe I do when they're looking at special teams and things, but I feel like the Ravens realized, whether unintentionally or what it was, they made a mistake by leaving him off the roster or the game day roster. And then also now we can say after the fact with Likely and Pat Ricard that, yeah, it would have been nice to put him on IR early, but those are two huge games that you just can't say if they're not there, oh, so be it, because the Lions and Chiefs, I mean, you like to have some wins there, but those were big ones.
I'll tell you what, a lot of that BS is gone this week. So they had a roster where they could pick and choose from the 53 all the way through. They didn't have anybody other than Lamar that was hurt. So everybody else was a healthy scratch that was on their inactive list, including players like Tez Walker, who's a fine special teams player. Sanusi Kane rode the inactive list this week. That's a very good indication that some things are changing in terms of how they're viewing. Now, they had other guys, Emory Jones, Carson Vinson, they're not special teams contributors, not a big deal. But when you have Kane and Walker, two guys who are big special teams contributors that are healthy scratches for a game, it shows you that the whole Ali Keaton Mitchell thing was a bunch of crap. And so there had to be something else. It had to be something Harbaugh didn't like about the way Mitchell was either practicing or perhaps he's putting the ball on the ground in practice. You know, that could always be the case. We're not privy to that. So it's not fair to say, but I will say Keaton Mitchell, just to echo your point, gives the Ravens something that they don't have otherwise. They have an incredible speed threat to the outside, and they can use it or not use it on a given play, which means has tremendous misdirection value. And we'll get into some of the ways they used it in a more specific sense a little bit later, but it's just great to see him back out on the field and doing what he did. And boy, was he feeling it after those runs.
I love what you said there, because like it is a matter whether it's pony or whatever you're trying to do. Cause I've said this before, you're playing football, you throw the ball deep, even if you don't complete it, now it's in their mind. They got to respect that. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. Like, I've been yelling all year long, please give Justice Hill the ball to run when he comes in every once in a while, so they don't know you're throwing it every time he's in the game. You know, and I think at times when you look at what Keaton Mitchell brings to the table, yeah, the body size, like, can it hold up for a full season? I don't know, but I sure want to find out. I want to give him his 6 to 8 plays a game that he's in there, that he's touching the ball, because you saw what, like, if you looked at the Chiefs when they got healthy and got guys off the suspended list, they got their explosive players back and how it changed. Now, the Ravens have explosive players. It's just going to be better by adding more in here, and I think Keaton Mitchell is definitely the definition of explosive.
I mean, for starters, Keaton Mitchell has had 69 career carries. Now, he did have a big injury after having the greatest 47 carry season of all time, but he did have a big injury. The durability, I'm not saying it's not a concern, but he just hasn't been given a chance. And if you basically want to put Keaton Mitchell on the bench for all time, you'd have lost the career of Lardarius Webb. You'd have lost a lot of great players who got injured in their rookie season. And, it was an enormously serious injury when it happened. It was the kind of career-turning injury you hate to see for a young player, that he may never really make it big in the league because of it. But there's also, you know, he's got to get another chance to run the football. And he looked like Keaton Mitchell 2023 on Sunday. That was great to see.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like with his size, I think is the concern that a lot of people would have. And Ken, I had my wife and I took in 2 kids. One was a college football player that has aspirations of playing in the NFL. And then I was trying to help him find an agent. And as soon as they heard his size, it was like, click. Does he run a 4.2? No, click. And it doesn't even matter what the film looks like, that you're almost X'd out.
And he weighs 165 pounds or something?
Yeah. Well, he weighs 100. It's all muscle, though. Uh-huh. He weighs, you're talking about a kid that's undersized. He's 5'8". He was a slot corner and one of the best in his, if you want to say conference, because he went to East Stroudsburg.
Okay.
So a smaller school.
Sure. What else do we want to talk about? We got to talk a little bit about the Lamar Jackson injury situation. Now, one of the reasons this is such a big story is because gambling and pro football are so connected. Now, this is not a new thing. It's always been true that gambling and pro football have been connected. But now the difference is the NFL is in bed with gamblers. And in a big way, and I kind of want to set this up a little bit, but the NFL changed the designation of the games they play to entertainment. And the reason for doing that, I believe, is so that they cannot be party to lawsuits that would accrue if anybody were to come up with allegations that the games were fixed. They're saying, look, this is entertainment. This is like pro wrestling. You want to bet on it, you know, caveat emptor. But don't tell me that you didn't know.
Yeah. Well, this is there's a lot of things to touch on here. I mean, if you start with, first off, talking about how the leagues have been in bed with gambling, whether people want to admit it or not. Monday Night Football was called bailout night. You know, it was your last night to try to win back whatever money you lost, and people would chase. I think there's also something to be said for now that the leagues are taking money and advertising with them, and we have what is DraftKings is. The home of the NFL, and I think the baseball and NBA, is that FanDuel, whoever they're in bed with. The funniest thing about all this stuff going down with gambling was the stuff that happened in the NBA. ESPN is literally doing a report on it, and there's a little thing on the ticker that says ESPN bet. Somebody must have saw it and said, you can't be promoting this now. Let's take this down. And they took it down in the middle of the segment. But now we've seen stories of players that were shaving points and doing all kinds of things with, as far as prop bets and things like that. And now you've heard of referees, and then now we have a coach that's involved. and all of those things that apply. Now, this isn't the same thing with just with Lamar, but when it comes to injury reports, they want everything to be on the up and up with the betting leagues, because like in the NBA, you have to have your starting lineup out a half an hour before the game. Has to come out. Mm-hmm. And that's so the bettors know who's playing, and then the line can move. Football, it's a little bit different because it's one game a week, but it does come down to something that's it's serious if you're going to kind of try to circumnavigate that.
Well, okay, so why would me as a skeptical person to that notion just say, hey, the inactive report comes out an hour and a half before game time. That's plenty of time to get your action down, whether you're doing it online or doing it over the phone with a local bookie, whatever it might be. You have time to make your wager after the inactives. Why are you trying to get your action down early? Well, I understand line movement and whatnot, but tell me why the injury reports on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday should carry the weight with the betting public that they do.
Well, I mean, I think there's especially when it comes to a quarterback, because it's the only position that really moves the line. I mean, we could sit here and talk about getting a couple of defensive players back and what that does for you, but quarterback's really the one that moves it significantly. But when it comes down to this situation, like, as you said, people like to get their bets in early and they like to get it at the best line. For books that were taking action, they'd be really upset if they had the Bears plus 6.5 after Lamar gets out. It doesn't matter when the game's over with, because you win it anyway. But those are locked in. They don't get voided. They don't get canceled. The only thing that would ever get canceled is in like Major League Baseball with starting pitchers. If one of them gets scratched and you didn't bet any bet or whatever, like any pitching matchup that happens, you bet action, then it doesn't matter who comes in. You still have it locked in at that line. But ultimately, I also think this is something, it's not just for gamblers, but it's for the other teams that are trying to prepare. I mean, you even heard they came out and said, hey, we prepared for Lamar all week. I don't think they were the least bit upset they didn't get to see Lamar, but that's who they got ready for. And I think that's a big part of it as well. That's where that gamesmanship comes in of, hey, we're not telling you who's starting this weekend, so prepare for both.
Are you expecting the Ravens to face any serious punishment from the league for this?
I don't think it's going to be serious. Initially, I thought it would be. But there is also the area of unknown. Was it just an honest mistake that Lamar was playing? I don't believe that, but like there is that area of it. And I think ultimately when I was reading what Adam Schefter had written about it, that they'll probably face a heavy fine. We'll see how significant it is. I don't know what heavy is when it comes to billionaires, but yeah, we'll see.
Let me juxtapose two things here. So we have the Lamar incident and the basically for people who don't know, and I think there are some people still have not heard, Lamar Jackson is listed as limited on the injury report. And if a starting player does not take his normal practice reps, then he has to be listed as, I'm sorry, he's listed as full. Then he has to be listed as limited. The Ravens did not do that. They say it was an honest mistake. He fully practiced. He was their scout team quarterback. He was there for, you know, kind of for the whole practice, I think is, you know, the way they put it. And they, you know, they reported the injury report as they thought was appropriate. And I think it's more likely the Ravens were trying to push Lamar towards the, hey, we listed you as full. Hopefully you're going to play on Sunday, than it is anything that they were trying to do the opponent or the betting public or anything else.
Well, let me ask you this, just to flip it back to you. Do you think, obviously, with the win, this works out better? He gets a little bit of rest. You get to see him on Thursday Night Football in Miami. He gets 10 more days to rest after that to see how things are holding up. And then we know how the schedule opens up as well. I mean, look, it ends up working out for the Ravens. And if you only get a slap on the wrist and a fine, you'd be happier than hell about that. They take away a draft pick, which that has been discussed, depending on the severity of it. You know, Ravens love their draft picks. That would really suck.
It would hurt tremendously. And let me just juxtapose the two situations here, because this is where I think if it's a draft pick, it would be completely unfair. In 2013, the Ravens played that Thanksgiving game against Tomlin. Jacoby Jones had a big run back on the down the left sideline. Tomlin stepped onto the field, obstructing Jones. And I was livid about that. That is a much more of a crime against the game than the listing of full or limited on an injury report is. I mean, it's an utter complete crime against the game to do that. And normally that's a, you know, it's the official has complete justification in terms of what sort of penalty he can impose, including just awarding a touchdown at that moment. That's been done before.
It happened in college a couple of times.
54 Cotton Bowl. That's right. Yeah. A very, very famous time it happened. So it's something that I think is a much more serious crime. Tomlin got fined $500,000 personally for that. Didn't bat an eyelash at it. Said, you know, all my money came from football. I understand. I take full responsibility, which he was saying immediately after the game. But there, I mean, I've seen if you there is a backside phone video of from the end zone that shows very clearly Tomlin did not just actually wander out and know where he was. He takes this measured step onto the field that you can see right down that sideline. I'm thinking,
and he does the thing that everybody does when it, whether it's a player with a foul and they put their hands up and just kind of lean like, oh, was I there? You know what? But the one thing about this, and this is the thing that bothers me about the league. There's no rhyme or reason to what they're doing as far as suspensions go. We've had so many things happen in this league where it's like the Ezekiel Elliott thing. They researched it, came back and said, hey, we didn't find anything. Okay, you still get six games. Before the Ray Rice incident, you know, domestic violence was a one-game suspension, and one guy got two games, and that's because he was a repeat offender. So there's really no rhyme or reason how they issue it out. It's basically a dictatorship with Roger Goodell, and whether you hurt the the shield, as they call it, the league, and you give it a bad look in the public, and they want to punish you because of that, he has the right to do whatever he wants.
Right. Well, I will say, the credibility of sports is critically important. And certainly that's true of football too. We all invest so much of our lives thinking about this. Most of us do. Anyway, I do. invest so much of our lives in just thinking about this game and enjoying it and whatnot. The credibility of it is absolutely critical. I don't want to be watching pro wrestling. I want to be watching, you know, a football game that I think is being contended right there on the field in front of my eyes. I don't want to have any sense of a script that's going on. Baseball has been through this in the 20s in particular. After the 1919 World Series got fixed, they had a bunch of players who got thrown out in the 1920s, including Ty Cobb was thought to have thrown a game in the 1920s, but like the final game of the 1923 season or thereabouts. There reportedly was a secret agreement not to kick him out of the game, but they kicked a bunch of other people out, including the eight White Sox and a bunch of other players who got tossed out after that. They had to clean house to get the thing right. The NBA scandal happening at the same time, does that mean there's extra impetus on the NFL to punish strictly on such events?
Almost make the Ravens like a martyr for it. You know, just, hey, here's the punishment. We don't want to see anybody do this again. I don't think that happens, but again, I can't sit here and speak to it and say, hey, they're definitely going to do this or that, because again, there's no rhyme or reason to the suspensions or penalties that they lay out. I do think, I never thought about, with the fact that the NBA issue happens, would the NFL take like stronger action because of that? Because the more and more that thing unfolds, that has layers. Oh my goodness. Now we're finding out about different poker games and players that were involved, right? And Antonio Gates and guys like that. So I just think this is such a black eye for sports that fans have always questioned this. See, they're on the take, they're cheating. And even now with the NFL, hey, we just got replay assist. Who told you to? Like, why didn't you do it for every play? Did you do it for our three plays when we were, you know, like, I just think there's a lot of gray area where fans can question things. So maybe it does affect it, but ultimately I don't think so.
Okay. I personally think one of the things you do if you work in finance, you really need to have a clean record of a lot of things. If you're want to be a branch manager for a bank, every bounced check that you've written in your life is a bad thing for you. But if any kind of financial crime is a non-starter in terms of promotions in financial fields. So it would, when I see that NBA players and coaches and whatever are cheating at poker, that's really serious. And that's a violation of a moral code that I don't think I can accept.
And they were ripping off their friends too. Their acquaintances, teammates. It's just unbelievable. They ripped off the longtime Nuggets announcer who tweeted out a picture going to play cards at Chauncey Billups' place tonight. And I don't know if you saw the cards they were using.
Oh yeah.
They were the ones where they wear glasses and you can read what the card is on the backside of it. So yeah. It's just terrible, man. I hate hearing this, because there's a lot of guys that are involved with this that I like. Like, I really like Chauncey Billups. The guy just went into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and he may never step on an NBA court again.
Yeah, he may be Pete Rose in the way things go. Anyway, a lot of problems here. You guys were getting a phone call right as I came into the booth this morning. It was about some guy who wanted to cash out his ticket on a 8 or 9 way parlay. that he would have won about $1,000 on. He ended up taking 490 instead. I think he had the Dodgers at home to finish the night, the final leg of the parlay.
And when they tied it up, that's when he decided to take the cash out. To which, when anybody ever asks me this, I'm team no cash out. Like, I understand if you put together some crazy bet, whatever, I'm throwing my lottery ticket in, it's $10, here's 10 teams or 10 plays, and all of a sudden you've hit 9 of them and it's a huge payout. I understand the person wanting to take that. I am never taking that. I am letting it ride. It just make you didn't fight all this way to get to this point, not for the huge payout, just to take the books want you to take that.
Of course. And when you're you need to look at this maybe from the book's perspective to understand why this is so valuable to them. This basically allows them to buy back their action with a second element of juice. So you won 9/10 of your bet by paying a lot of juice to make that action. Okay. You there's a lot of vig involved, a lot of expected win for the house that was involved in that. And then they threw on another layer of expected win on your ticket because you decided you want to sell it back to them. The comparable thing that a lot of people do in real life is like to try and cash out their annuities with like a JG Wentworth or something. You're paying a second amount on that. It's just it's garbage business. Anyway, JG Wentworth, I have no desire to have you as a sponsor ever.
Yeah, I was just going to do their opening thing. JG Wentworth.
There you go. So anyway, let's get back to the game here a little bit. Good day for most of the offensive line. We're going to get to that in a little bit. Really much needed day to have a good day pretty much across the offensive line. Stanley recovered from some bad games, played well. The other guy who played very well for the first time in a long time is Linderbaum. He had an outstanding game, so it's something to be discussed. And we'll get to that probably the second half of the show. The other thing I thought was good was that the play calling that Monken did really went after a weak defense. Now, a lot of times you'll hear people talk about play calling and they don't really know what they're talking about. And there's, I want to see some variation. I want to see some of this. The thing I liked about it specifically was that the Bears came into this game very shorthanded in the secondary. And on the other side of that, you have Huntley, a guy who needs to have the ball schemed out of his hands so his pocket presence doesn't become a problem, and pocket awareness doesn't become a problem. And they didn't make as many concessions to that as they might otherwise have done, and they were still able to go after those cornerbacks fairly aggressively.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about too with this Bears defense and being down some pieces in the secondary and what they allowed them to do. Coming in and seeing how they called some of those plays. Now, I'll tell you this much, from doing radio, I know the type of play calls that fans like, the ones that work. That's the only one. That's it, Ken.
And they'll look backwards. That worked. That didn't. That was that 0 and 1 yard game. Those were terrible. The -4. That was the worst play call I've ever seen. And
I go 10 back and 20. To the Mark Andrews 2-point conversion in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Phenomenal play design. Horrible execution. So why are you mad at the play call? If they didn't get it done, they didn't do their job. Now, again, that might be more of an extreme because it's the end of the game and people are watching and maybe want to see something different. But I always talk about it. I try to bring it up as much as I can whenever teams go for it on fourth down and get it, because when they don't get it, it was a stupid call. Whenever teams like we finally had a team this week. So hopefully the analytical people out there can see what the Jets did going for two and then coming back and winning that game because they got the 2-point conversion the first time. So I just feel like there's a lot of things that fans don't see into it, but everybody's going to tell you. They can look and say, oh, Henry only got 9 carries. Okay, was that a screw-up for the Ravens, or did game flow kind of take him out of it? Because that's also a possibility. But, yeah, the only play they like are the ones that work.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to show you a slide. I'm doing a presentation for an actuarial group coming up about football analytics and what I'm doing now in my post-actuarial career. And one of the very first slides, actually the very first slide of the entire presentation, is on going for it for 2 when down 8 and how you solve for that with the quadratic formula and whatnot. You would know this, by the way. You might know it off the top of your head, but when I say, and people out there listen, I know we've got a lot of STEM people, a lot of math and science people, but when I say negative B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 4AC all over 2A, do you remember that formula from high school?
I know that formula. What's it called? Because I'm blanking on that.
The quadratic equation.
I know what you're talking about. So I'm so far removed from my math days, but I was a math major. I took calc in my senior year of high school and calc 2 my freshman year of college. But for some reason, I always kind of flock to that. And I'm assuming you did too, Ken.
Yeah. Well, I'm a math guy, but so, but anyway, let's go ahead and talk about Keaton Mitchell a little bit more in terms of some of the stuff. And I did some notes. Actually, I didn't put these in here, and I apologize for that, but I did them in the 105.7 notes if you have those from this morning. Yep, still,
I got it right here in front of me.
So Mitchell only played 7 snaps, but I really love the way that it did not matter that there was blocking in front of him. And in fact, the Monken just middle fingered the need for blocking in this game. So I'm going to take you through each of his 5 runs here. And he had one of them that got negated by penalty that we'll talk about in here. He had a zone run left for 3 yards. The very first play, they pulled left on the play. So the center and the left tackle, both Stanley and Linderbaum, both pulled, and they both missed their blocks. And so did one other guy. And he still outraced everybody on that left side for 25 yards. So that was his own run that way. It was all, you know, expected to do that. He had 2 pullers on the play. Then they run this zone run for left for 3 yards. Nothing really special about that play. Third play, they ran counter. Okay, now what that means is that that 2 players are pulling, usually a tackle and a guard, but it can be a tackle to center. In this case, it was the tackle and the guard both pull to the left. They gave the ball to Mitchell out of sidecar left, which means he's coming across the quarterback's face in that direction. And he just took the ball right, and every defender had flowed after him. He was easily able to outrun the missteps of the players who remained on that right side, got a 13-yard run on that play.
The great thing about that, too, is when you look at Keaton Mitchell, you give guys the way where they're going the opposite way. They're going that direction. All he needs is a fraction of a second to beat those guys to the outside, and you're giving him that with that play.
Yeah, that half misstep. And, you know, one of the things I look at is there's a bunch of advanced scouts looking at this game for the next few opponents the Ravens will have. And advanced scouting usually goes – the Ravens' trick, I think, is to go back 4 games to do the most current advanced scouting on the team. It may be more than that because Lamar has been out. They may look at this game differently because Huntley was in and not take as much of a waiting on it, as if you want to think of it that way. But they're going to look at this game and they're going to see how Mitchell ran, and they got to be throwing their arms up in the air in terms of how they defend it. And when he's on the field, I mean, how do you assign someone to defend that? Anyway, you at least have to account for it on every play he's out there. And that's what's so beautiful about what he did in this game.
Yeah. And look, I mean, watching a guy that can do what he can do when things break down, and presence of mind, like, it's amazing. You miss 2 blocks and you see, because he's so fast, he's able to find that edge and get down there. And he does, man. He scoots. Like, you're watching it, because there are some guys who just have like long strides.
Yeah.
And he's just bang, 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 gone. And I love the fact, again, mixing him in. I wish we would have seen this from the beginning of the year. I don't know if it would have mounted to more wins, but I think they got a special player on their hands if they figure out a way to use him. And I think Munkin's the right guy to. So hopefully we get to see more of it.
Yeah, I would love to see him at a pony more. Anyway, just want to finish this real quickly. So they had the counter play where he pulled left and got a 13-yard run. Then they did the exact same opposite in the opposite direction. The left guard and left tackle pulled to the right. Mitchell ran left to the empty side of the field here, where and he tried a cutback early. That play actually looked like if he continued to the outside, he would have beaten the edge defender there, and he would have had a pretty big play, but he decided to cut it back between 2 defenders, and he didn't break a tackle, and he gained only 2 yards. Anyway, great stuff. He did have a gap run at the end where he bounced outside, broke a tackle, had an 8-yard gain that got negated by defensive offsides. So it was an 8-yard gain, 5-yard offsides. They wanted to save the down. That came up, by the way, interesting play there. I didn't think they talked about it on TV, but Billings, I almost said Billups there, but Billings, the nose tackle, was intentionally offsides on 2nd and 3. Actually, encroachment. He just knocked the center directly over before he snapped the ball. He's obviously been told to do that from the sideline. But it was interesting, you know, gamesmanship, little play there by the Bears to try and stay in it.
I love that stuff. I mean, we talk about it all the time. We mentioned today, even Harbaugh in the Super Bowl, some of the decisions he's made. I mean, you got to give him credit for those things. I just think there's a lot of forward thinkers in this league. And that was one of those ones where it's like, oh, there's another one for the competition committee. Let's see what we can do here.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're I don't know if they'll ever do anything about the intentional offsides. The Ravens, Chuck Clark did it three times in his Ravens career, where he was in the backfield and just like his hand ready to strip the quarterback as soon as he got out of the yard.
See, I don't think there's anything you can do because you're not going to decline it. It's a first down and a whole new set of downs. Okay, you want to give me 5 yards. It's not like the game you would play with, I'm on the 45-yard line, let me get the delay game. I decline it, delay again, yep. You know, and you're going back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah. That's enough on that. Great stuff. Want to see Pony anyway. Want to see Mitchell and Pony with Henry. I don't think it has to be Mitchell taking Henry snaps, but I thought it would be fun on this episode if I could do it. I don't think I could do it with a straight face to say, just tell me, why is Henry taking so many of Mitchell's snaps?
Yeah.
Just do that for the entire episode. See if we can keep it up.
Get everybody angry.
Yeah,
look, I would love to see that. And again, with the play designs that you have, I mean, you add in a Zay Flowers to mix in that. There's a lot of different things you can do from a running standpoint. You don't even have to be throwing the football. But also having them on the field, you have to respect it. That's why I like seeing them out there more.
All right. Well, I'm sure we will see more now. I think we need him for special team stuff was over with this game with some of the deactivations they had. Did a real good job of converting more on two downs in this game. One of the things we've been talking about is the Ravens staying in manageable ahead of the stick situations. It's often meant, particularly with Cooper Rush or Huntley in there, that they were trying to get into third and short. The best way to not get into third and short is to make it on two downs. And they did a better job of that in this game.
Yeah, and again, like we go back to Huntley. I don't know what fans' expectations were when they heard he was playing. He had a couple of throws that I think he's very fortunate how it ended up.
Yes.
But for the most part, outside of that, like, didn't turn the ball over, did everything he needed to do to win the game. I didn't think there was anything, I don't want to say special about it. I mean, he still added in, 50-some rushing yards as well.
Yeah, but he probably did have about 1.2 expected turnovers in this game, and he's actual zero. Yeah. That's a darn good fortunate thing. That in particular, the pass that was deflected by Edmonds looked like Byard was going to have an interception on it. I thought the strip sack looked like it had fumble and lost fumble written all over it, and somehow he managed to recover it. I can't even understand how in a way.
Everybody who played wide receiver says you wouldn't be a defensive back if you could catch, so you'd be on this side of the ball.
All right. Speaking of Zay, he remains a player who can't be covered, a guy who got free for Huntley to find him. In fact, really all the Ravens receivers played pretty well. Hopkins had his moments and Bateman had a couple long balls and whatnot. So it was fine day for the receivers in this game. But Zay is the guy that when he's crossing, nobody can stay with him.
So we had a caller call in and talk about Zay. Do you have any issue or it's like live with it, die with it, with the jumping back? Hey, I'm getting there have been times I got the first down and now I go backwards or I'm trying to make a bigger play and I don't get to the line to gain. Any issues with that at all?
Small price to pay, I will say. And that's often the time with smaller receivers. I think Marquise Brown, I would associate with it, is they try and make a U-turn move on the player by coming back to the ball and then U-turning with, which has to generally allow space so they don't allow a downhill tackle right away. And you can often get a miss out of it. It's the same thing that people used to say about Deion Sanders when he used to go backwards 3 yards to return a punt. Be like, no, you're going the wrong way. Oh, yeah, that's good. That's what I intended. So I think it's a small price to pay. Same thing from Ed Reed returning a ball out of the end zone. I mean, how often did that really not work out for the Ravens?
And Ed Reed lateraling the ball.
That's another good one. Yeah. So players manage risk pretty well on the field. I will say Zay is one of the few Ravens who's had some real problems with on-field game management decisions. So specifically, there's two big ones I can point to. One is getting the fair catch on the free kick that ended up losing the Colts game, 23 that was in. The other one was the time he had the game-winning run against the Chargers in LA, and it was a game-winning third-down conversion. He went all the way for a touchdown. And actually, after he had the first down, if he'd gone down, it would have been 100% chance to win, but he changed it back to about, 97% chance to win by scoring.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of thing he just should have done. And occasionally I find wide receivers to be the most likely to make a mistake of that type.
It's them. And, well, I mean, look, we're going to talk about all the guys that touch the ball, but running backs drive me insane when you're running out the clock.
Yeah.
Like, why are you running out of bounds? Why are you even slide down? The yardage doesn't matter at this point. It's just unreal.
we can talk about that right now. I mean, Hopkins obviously had a play that I thought was less egregiously bad. It was a back shoulder play. Kind of was, his body was turning in that direction. It would have been difficult, but if he'd had the presence of mind, catch the back shoulder throw and then just immediately go down or force the defender to push you backwards out of bounds, that keeps the clock running.
Yep.
Those things would have been fine there. That way it happened was not. And of course, Mitchell had a first down run that he went out of bounds on, and that he could have slid down like a quarterback, three yeah. yards short of where he did. So that was a little unfortunate, but he was feeling it, no doubt about it. And I'm less upset about it right now than I would have been if the Ravens had somehow found a way to lose that game.
Did you think that was offensive pass interference on D-Hop, or was that just hand fighting?
It could have been called. I mean, it's pretty close. I'm not a big guy to like say, oh, that was terrible, and that, you know, that play by the ref. The one in this game that I thought was really bad was the quick whistle on the on Marlon Humphrey on the forward progress, which I don't know how it could be that quick.
So Ken, I am the guy that's going to yell at the refs and tell them it's terrible in this league for that. That drove me insane for all the things that happen with wide receivers making catches. Is it a catch? Is it not? Did he make a football move? Hell, Dez Bryant makes this amazing catch in the postseason, diving for the pylon. It's like, no, he didn't maintain it to the ground. And with that play, they gave us no rhyme or reason for it. So, yeah, that right. bothered me a lot. Almost as much as the World Series with the thing that happened with Bo Bichette, where the umpire didn't make the right call. He didn't call it. He called it late, and then they end up getting the guy out. It's like, these are key moments, and you need every one of those moments.
Right. Yeah, I wish they had more that they could do with replay assist on that. But we talked about this a little bit this morning. I don't remember if we were on air, if we were talking like between segments or whatever, but all they would need is to have the whistle be electronic and have the sound of it go to New York the same way the video does. And then they can tell how quick that whistle is blown, whether it was a quick whistle. The problem is once you blow a ball dead, then both the offensive and defensive player might be letting up, and you really don't know. I mean, they're told to do that. They're told to let up at that point. What the officials are not doing properly, in my opinion, is they're not letting a little additional contact happen in that situation to determine if that ball might be turned over. And they're very good about it on a ball that's on the ground. They try not to blow the ball dead. They try not to make a decision about whether a pass was completed or not. And then fumbled. They let it play out. Then they go to the tape, and then they don't have the problem that they otherwise might, like on this play.
Yeah. And there's been, like, we even had the play earlier this year where they went up and ran a play, and then they stopped it and went back to the previous play and said they stepped out of bounds. It's like, well, how on earth are you taking us back after we ran a play? I just want things to be uniform. I want to know as a fan, but I'm sure coaches, players, what is a catch? You tell me the definition and you change it. When they allowed you to challenge pass interference, they're like, hey, you can't do this. And then all of a sudden you're like, that's what you told me he couldn't do. Well, he didn't do it egregiously enough. It's like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, if ever there's a time where I thought the officials were covering for their own behavior, the challenged pass interferences was one that, you know, if it's treated like a normal challenge where it's got to be, you know, irrefutable evidence kind of thing, then you're already putting yourself in a hole in terms of officiating that correctly. They've got a little better scheme this year. They have four penalties. Helmet to helmet is one of them, but there are four total where the replay assist can negate a call on the field. They can't make a new call on the field, but they can negate a call on the field. They came to talk to us at camp for that. One of the officials did. That was I thought that was very well done.
But I hate that they do that, because that brings in that entertainment part that you talked about in the beginning, because what you're going to randomly pick which plays you're going to do it for every play. Are we going to get it? Cause I just don't see it happening that way. And that, it, look, with all the things that are going on, it makes me question a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, the rules of football are incredibly complex and very difficult to officiate to start with. So I have some sympathy for those folks and how they're doing their job.
And with that Humphrey play, Gene Steratore did, like, J.J. Watt's the one was like, well, what about this? Because the ball never touched the ground, that he didn't make. It's not a catch. And then Gene Steratore's like, it's a good question, J.J. He didn't know either.
It would have been either an interception or a fumble recovery if the ball had been ruled in Humphrey's possession. But because it hadn't been a catch yet, it probably should have been 3 or 4 yards back from the spot, because he's bobbling it through there. Yeah. All right, let's move on here. I thought the Ravens did have good run-pass balance in this game. And even in Q4, when they're putting the game away, they still threw when they had to. They came back on the second and 10 play through that, you know, great misdirection play to Kolar, where they it had components of rub and misdirection in there. Kolar actually fakes a block at the line of scrimmage, crosses the formation. If one of those two guys probably should have covered him that he crossed, but A, there was a rub, and B, they blew the coverage anyway. I don't think either of them knew that they had to cover Kolar. And then they went back and threw the ball there. But I like that play in particular. But I like the fact also that the balance was good throughout the game.
Yeah, I told you. I think I told you earlier today. But I that play, when it was happening, I'm like, come on, just run the damn. I'm like, because
yes.
It's like you want to secure the win. And then, all yeah, it's a no, yes. The kid on your team taking that horrible three-pointer. No. Oh, okay, that went in. Don't do it again. but no, the play design was absolutely beautiful the way it's set up.
Yeah. Yep. And then I guess one last thing I'd say about this game is against the Rams, they kind of stayed in the game with a ton of Rams mistakes. The Rams gave away a lot of points on the field, threw the ball away, dropped passes, had an illegal downfield on a punt that was fumbled, called a ridiculous timeout when they're up for, sorry, went for it on fourth down. Ridiculously, when they're up 14 with the chance to go up 17 and make it a three-score game, they just gifted the Ravens an extra chance to stay in the ball game. That I did not really feel like the Bears did that. I felt like they faced a good young quarterback. That quarterback knew what he was doing in terms of getting the ball to receivers. The receivers were a high-quality group that had their chances, and I didn't feel they left a lot of plays on the field. The one exception would be the very last offensive play they had, where they threw it to the back of the end zone, wide-open receiver, and missed him.
Ravens made me feel like they're like one of those defensive boxers where you're feeling out your opponent, because those first two drives off the bye week, we were talking about it. Rome had a great drive, had a great couple of drives. And then it's almost like those two drives, okay, we got it figured out. I know what they're doing now. And then boom, just locked in. I'm hoping we're going to see this run defense look as good as it has been.
Yeah.
And I think they will against Miami, but like it, I don't know that the pass rush is going to get better without them generating something. Or making some sort of move before the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, they did. They had a lot of problem with scheme in this game. Everything they did from scheme and numbers really didn't work for them in this game. That's relatively small sample size, but the best thing they did was just to rush four. And you wouldn't think that, but they held the Bears to 5.2 yards per play on those. Everything else was a lot worse. I want to flip the script to talk about the offense here and how Huntley did against numbers here. And mostly I want to talk about Huntley's opportunity set. So here's what I'm going to tell you. If you want the pass rush by numbers, go to the article on the offensive line. That's already out now, since you'll be listening to this probably on Wednesday. It was out on Tuesday. And that has all the rush by numbers. But five-man rush in particular is not particularly effective versus Huntley. And he had 12.3 yards per play when they did that. Huntley did not have a good opportunity set, however, in this game. He only had five ample time and space opportunities. That's 21%. He had four of those five completed for 73 yards. So big 14.6 yards per play on those passes. Normally, Huntley kind of lives and dies with his BOQ results, is how he does when the ball's out quickly, because it has to be schemed out quickly a lot. Eight of those in this game, 33%. It's probably even less than normal for him, but they went 6 of 8. He went 6 for 8 on those passes. For 33 yards. That's not good, folks. 4.1 yards per play. Should be about 6 yards per play he would get on those throws. So he made it with ATS, and then he also made it with pressure. He got pressured 46% of the time, 11 times on 24 dropbacks that resulted in a pass or sack. And he completed 7 of 9 of those for 72 yards. That doesn't seem like much at 6.5 yards per play, but the expectation of those is for about 3.5 yards per play. So a good job. And most importantly, he didn't turn the ball over. So he beat his opportunity set by about 57 yards or 2.4 yards per play. And I know I just said a whole lot there. I want to take a breath. And what did you think about Huntley?
I mean, I thought he played well. And again, I want to give him a little bit more credit for just being a manager of the game. There were a couple times he made plays. I love the fact that, you know, there was this give and take, like Bateman with that catch that kind of bails him out. He left him short, but bail out your quarterback, you know. And there were a couple of times where you're looking at it and I'm wondering, I'm like, same thing you are. Like, okay, he's going to hit his first read. They're going to have something schemed, or he's waiting for this to open up underneath. But I thought he did make a couple of really good throws in key situations on third downs. But they did feel like they were throwing it a lot more on first But I'd have to go back and look at it. You probably know better than I do. It's just you're watching the game, and I'm going, I feel like they have been throwing it quite a bit.
Yeah, it's I didn't think they limited the game plan like they normally have for him quite as much. But then I look at the time to throw, and it was still 264, which was the seventh lowest in the league this week. That's a low number. For Jackson, I would consider that to be a very bad thing because it means that the other team is getting pressure on Lamar Jackson quickly enough that he's getting rid of it. And it probably also means you don't have two or three extended plays for Jackson in the game that have really upped the average. Like Jackson is capable any week of putting an 8 or 9 second play on the board that will massively increase his average in these cases. So the seventh lowest for Huntley, I think, it fits who he is as a quarterback. So I didn't think it was bad. And then I get the other part of it, and his completed air yards were the fifth best in the entire NFL. And I don't have the right number there. I do have it here on NFL Jesus. It'll take me a second to get this back, but he was outstanding in those terms. I'll have it for you in a second here.
Yeah. And again, when you're looking at what Huntley did in the game, I think moving the ball around, they add Zay into the running game a little bit. He gets into the running game. Felt like you talked about it. The pass to run ratio was a very good mix. At the end of the game, I was saying, man, I didn't think Derrick Henry got enough touches. And you look at it, he got 21. So
yeah.
I feel like if the offense can do this with Lamar back there and these guys are staying healthy and you have those pieces, this is a very, very dangerous team.
By the way, Huntley, fifth highest in completed air yards at 8.4. That is a very weak category for him. So that should tell you he took more shots down the field. And the throw, in particular, the long throw to Bateman was a good one. He left one pass he left on the field, even though Flowers was double covered on the field. It looked like he had a step on the defenders there and a space on the field that Huntley could have hit him, but was slightly overthrown. It happens to every quarterback. You leave a couple throws on the field, but that was unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, outside of, as you said, the one ball that hit Byard in the hands, it was tipped. There weren't a ton of mistakes. There weren't a ton of things you look at. Like even that incomplete pass to Zay, as you said, double covered down the field, and you complete it, great. You know, you got a chance for pass interference, but he put the ball where he needed to so it couldn't be turned over.
Right. Yeah, that's how it works sometimes. All right, want to get back to the best ever backup quarterback performances in Ravens history, and I have two for you. So the first is the Anthony Wright game, and I'll give a little more detail on that. That was 11-23-03 versus Seattle. The Ravens were down in that game 41-24 with less than 7 minutes remaining, about 6:50 remaining. The comeback starts, and by the way, this is exactly, it's coincidental, of course, but this is exactly the point from which I start watching this recording whenever I put it into the DVD player. But there is Ed Reed blocked the punt with 6:50 to go, runs it into the end zone himself to bring the Ravens within 10. Then they got a big strip by Ray Lewis on Max Strong. They complete a 4th-and-28 pass to keep their drive alive. Then they tipped pass for 44 yards. Then they scored another touchdown to Marcus Robinson after that. Then they threw a long pass to Marcus Robinson after getting the ball back after some disputed clock. You remember that disputed clock there?
Didn't they get 5 downs in that game? Is that what happened too?
Like they did not start the clock appropriately after a penalty had been called on the Ravens.
Okay,
the Ravens ended up with an extra 30 seconds. They got the ball back with like 39 seconds to play or something in the game, down 3. The first play, was a long pass interference call where Marcus Trufant cut off Robinson down the field. And then they were basically in field goal range just about then, but they completed one more 10-yard pass. Stover kicked a field goal, got him to overtime. Dilfer came in overtime for Seattle, which was a real cool thing. and then Boulware got up a 15-yard sack. Ravens completed a 3rd-and-15 to Marcus Robinson, which was one of the biggest plays of the game. And then Stover kicked a game-winning field goal. I know that game really well, but there's about 15 plays from that game that I've got like visual memory of even after 22 years. Well, that's very vivid.
Isn't that game like the Wilt Chamberlain 100-point game because so many people left and they were trying to get back in and they couldn't? Yes. And now everybody was there. Oh, I was there for that one. And there were so many people that left early. And I just remember one of my friends in it, and then they heard the score, and it was like, well, we might as well just go back in and watch. You're like, no returns.
But we were, I would say, and this may have something to do with the acoustics of the stadium, whether humans or concrete conduct noise better or whatever it is, but it was loud as hell in there at the end of the game, even with the stadium half filled. But there were a lot of people missing, and we went kind of triumphantly to visit business associates afterwards at Edgar's, and they had already gotten through a couple plates of appetizers, and I'm like, yes, we got that done properly. Yeah. Did you enjoy watching the game on TV here?
It's great.
All right. So, okay. Here is number two on that. Anthony Wright, by the way, had his first child, I believe, that night after the game. So big bonus points if you want to consider that.
He and Marcus Robinson, South Carolina guys. I thought that was the connection there between them. They both went to South Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, but obviously Marcus Robinson's biggest game as a pro too. The other one is Trent Dilfer. Now the game is 11-5 2000. The Ravens have just had no touchdowns for 20 consecutive quarters, and Dilfer leads them to a 27-7 win at Cincinnati, which at the time wouldn't seem like anything really special because they killed Cincinnati in that era regularly. But he had three touchdowns, no interceptions, 117.8 passer rating, and it was the first of 11 consecutive wins leading all the way through Super Bowl 35. So those are two strong contenders for Huntley's great game. But I think, boy, we're going to remember Huntley's game in the same light if this turns the Ravens season around.
Oh, this will be one of those great stories in the middle of the season where you're watching your Super Bowl. Well, you're not watching VHSs anymore, right? Are you still getting DVDs? What are people doing? I guess you're downloading it, your Super Bowl run, and seeing that story right in the middle of it. Like, you remember when you guys were 1-5? That's crazy.
I still have my CDs. That's my archiving system still, but I agree it's a little outdated at this point. What else do we want to say about this? I think we talked about the heavies already. I'm gonna let off on some of this. One thing I'll say about the Ravens' pass rush blocking scheme is that they had 13 set and 7 chip blocks in this game. That's 0.83 per passer sack, which is kind of high. And I look at this and I look at the Bears don't have a super impressive group of edge rushers. Montez Sweat is pretty good, and he's on the typically opposite the right tackle. And on the other side, they had, I don't know if I could pronounce his name, Odeyingbo. Do you know how to pronounce that name?
Yeah, I don't know. Yingbo.
Yeah, nailed it. It's good. but I think that the set blockers they used in this game were more a function of Huntley's substandard pocket presence and possibly also the fact that they didn't know exactly where Ronnie Stanley was, that he'd had obviously problems, didn't finish any of the last three games, was sat out one and didn't finish the other two, played poorly in the two games he played. Might very well have been a case where they just felt like they couldn't take a chance on Huntley under pressure in the pocket there.
Yeah. And I mean, were you concerned at all with Stanley went down. I thought it was going to be serious at first, but it's like, don't do that now. They just got a little healthy. Don't do it now.
Yeah, I mean, he went right back in, but then I looked at the tape and honestly looked like he got kneed in the family jewels.
Yeah, so that'll do it. Yeah, that'll take your wind right away from you.
And he was on the field like there was, you know, he's never been in more pain. And the trainers were out there and they weren't looking at his ankle, which should have been a first sight that, you know, it's something else. You know, so maybe he got punched in the stomach, wind knocked out of him. This is the worst way to get the wind knocked out of you. There are a few women listening. You probably have an idea from your husband or a friend of yours, just how bad it is to be kicked down there, but it's bad.
You know that song, Take My Breath Away? I think it was written about being kicked in the boys. That's what I think.
All right. Jeremy, always great talking football with you. And I enjoy time with you here and time at the station so much, but tell folks where they can find what you're working on, maybe your gambling website or anything else you'd like to plug.
Yeah, so I'm actually doing quite a bit. So obviously with the morning show, I have my own website called ConcreteLocks.com, but I also work with this company called Pick Dogs, and I do a daily podcast, and it's kind of like a look ahead. So we look ahead to the next day. It gets posted in the morning. So I'm doing stuff the day before. I always catch myself going, today on Tuesday, damn it, what day is it? Wednesday I'm doing this. But I do one every day of the week. And I also have been, Baltimore people know Mark Zeno. I do a football and college football half-hour podcast with him called Top Dogs. So it's all on YouTube. Check it out over there.
All right, fun stuff. Give Jeremy's stuff a chance. And always listening to 105.7 in the morning, you get a healthy dose of a little bit of everything, I'd say, from that morning crew. You guys are a great group to put together. You got some seriousness and you got some funny, and you got some great broadcast presence and whatnot from the three of you that I think is certainly a lot of fun to go in and interact with when I'm there.
I really appreciate it. I feel like we're the guys at the end of the bar that Harbaugh was talking about. So that's how it feels sometimes.
All right. Well, other folks out there, thanks very much for listening. As always, we really appreciate the loyalty to the show during the season. Listens have been great. Please tell one other person about the show. I depend on word of mouth, even in this era of algorithms and whatnot, getting the word out there. But if you can show one particularly older person who might like my content how to play the podcast directly from the website, that's always what I ask as a primary. If you're out on YouTube, like and subscribe, please. And if you've got time, a five-star, 50-word review is always appreciated. Jeremy, thanks again for coming on.
Anytime.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.